You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Turkey goes to war in Syria on two fronts. On one, they're being supported by American air power. On the other, they're fighting America's allies. Whose side are they actually on? My guests, Rosemary Hollis and Sebastian Borger, will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Angela Merkel's European tour. Do the 27 remaining members yet have a coherent idea of the EU without the UK? Austria's presidential election rerun. Can the far right win on the second attempt? And
I am going right now to invite onto the stage the man behind Brexit, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Nigel Farage.
Donald Trump unveils his new warm-up act. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Rosemary Hollis, Professor of International Politics at City University here in London, and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both. We will start in Syria, where the five-year-old question as to which side Turkey is actually on has been furnished with some sort of answer, at least over the last few days. Turkish tanks have crossed the border in support of an apparently successful assault on the Islamic State-held town of Jarablus by rebels of the Free Syrian Army. What remains unclear is the degree to which Turkey felt ridding Jarablus of IS was a worthwhile end in itself, or whether they were more concerned with stopping Kurdish militias from taking it first. Rosemary, first of all, as we noted in the introduction to the programme, America aids and trains the Kurdish rebels, who Turkey is fighting against, but also flew air cover for the Turkish army and their Syrian allies, who are also fighting the Syrian Kurds and Islamic State, and unless I've missed something there.
Well, the United States doesn't support all Kurds. They don't support the PKK, which is the main Turkish Kurdish organization, and the Americans still consider that a terrorist organization. But as far as the Turks are concerned, almost all Kurdish causes and Kurdish activists are bad news. And they've been fretting enormously because, as part of the US operation inside Syria to take on IS, the Kurds, those that live in Syria, have been gaining ground at the expense of not only IS, but also the Arab population of Syria. And the Assad regime in Syria has turned a blind eye to the advance of the Kurdish cause in northern Syria because it is not in the forefront of the anti-Assad campaign in the whole of Syria. I mean, you know, we could go round and round in circles in terms of who is exactly doing what to whom. But I think the most interesting aspect of the recent developments is that Joe Biden, the US vice president, has been in Turkey and told the Kurdish allies of the United States to hold back whilst the Turkish forces, the Arab Syrian forces with whom they are allied, went in and, as you said, took over a town from ISIS, which damages ISIS' means of communication across the border into Turkey, but also prevents the Kurds from making that gain.
Sebastian, as Rosemary quite correctly points out, Joe Biden, speaking for the United States, was very, very explicit in warning the Syrian Kurds, who America also backs, to stay on the west bank of the Euphrates River opposite Jarablus. Do you get the impression that America is in any sense dictating events in Syria at the moment, or are they just desperately trying to keep up with them?
I would have thought the latter. You know, let's be fair to the Western effort and say, and I suppose we have to say it to the Russian effort as well, and say that IS-Daesh has lost ground, which is good news. That's the only good news I think we've had from Syria. Apart from that, I don't see a clear strategy from the Americans. I see only tactics.
I suppose you could be glad that the Assad regime was upset by developments, the Turkish cooperation, and the Russians were not as upset as the Assad regime.
I mean, Rosemary, Turkey's foreign minister, Mevlut Cavusoglu, has said today that Daesh, which is what he calls Islamic State, should be completely cleansed from our borders. He is, of course, alluding to the fact that the Islamic State hold a portion of Syria's border that the Syrian Kurds presently do not. Is that actually what Turkey is trying to do, or are they basically trying to get everybody they don't like away from their borders, which then does rather prompt the question of who they would rather have there?
Oh, well, actually, Turkey has had for many years ambitions for Syria. And up until very, very recently, their primary goal in Syria...
Sorry, when you say ambitions, do you mean actual territorial conquest?
No. Ambitions for the Assad regime to be gone and a more amenable ally of Turkey to replace him. But the Turks, through force of circumstances, I would suggest, have had to revise their confrontation with the Russians, which means pulling back somewhat on the hitherto virulent opposition to the Assad regime. And the Americans, because they're in the doghouse in Turkey, because they give safe haven to Fethullah Gulen, who's accused of being behind the coup that nearly succeeded in toppling Erdogan, the Turkish president, the Americans are having to make nice to the Turks to convince them that they're not anti the Erdogan regime. So there's some very interesting maneuvering going on. The principal battleground is Syria at the moment, but there's multiple games going on. And I think it's not the Americans who are in the driving seat, but the Russians are getting more and more help from both the Turks and the Americans, which is having a tempering effect on Russian ambitions, but is leaving behind the French and the British, who are much more purist about what should happen in Syria.
Sebastian, as Rosemary points out, this is still only a matter of weeks since the attempted coup d'etat in Turkey. It does seem like an awful lot of news has happened this year, and you forget how recent quite a lot of it was. Strangely, that seems like something that happened years ago. But nonetheless, is there, do we think, maybe an element of Erdogan trying to throw his military a morale-improving victory in the field here? Because, of course, there has been a massive purge of the Turkish military, as there has been of many other areas of Turkish public and private life. Is there him thinking that, you know, I give them a victory that will make them loyal, it will make them like me again?
And the victory being?
Well, they have...
Smashing the Kurds, they always like that.
Smashing the Kurds does always cheer the Turkish military up, and they can, of course, now claim, apparently, to have participated in a victory against Islamic State, which, following last weekend's bombing in Gaziantep, will be a morale booster as well, you would think.
Or are we seeing the end game in Syria? I mean, let's be optimistic for once and say this is now going...
Good luck with this, but carry on.
This is now going to be, he's trying to stake a claim, and a territorial claim, actually, in what is going to be a divided country.
What do you think, Rosemary?
That's an interesting way of putting it. I would say that he is absolutely determined that the Kurds do not assert independence right the way across from the Mediterranean coast to join up with the semi-autonomous Kurdish enclave inside Iraq. But looming in the background, we've got the battle for Mosul. And the UN is warning, and this is in northern Iraq and held by ISIS. And the repercussions of the Iraqi army with American backing trying to take Mosul back from ISIS fighters will squeeze out across the border. So what I see here is that there's this squeezing operation going on. You can't eliminate ISIS completely. You squeeze it and there's real people in it, including not just fighters. And they kind of squeeze from the area under greatest bombardment into another part of this mixture of Iraq and Syria that, as I think you rightly say, is going to break up and not look like Iraq and Syria used to.
Okay, well, let's move along now to that European tour currently being undertaken by German Chancellor Angela Merkel as she seeks to shore up alliances. What a phrase to put in a radio script. She seeks to shore up. Who writes this, honestly? Ahead of next month's informal EU summit in Bratislava, at which, of course, the primary subject under discussion will be the non-attendee, i.e. the UK. Merkel plans to meet 15 EU leaders this week. Yesterday she was in Tallinn, today Prague, tomorrow on to Warsaw before returning to Berlin to host various visiting heads of government. Sebastian, what is beneath all this charging about by Merkel? Is she claiming and or acknowledging that now more than ever the Chancellor of Germany is the de facto head of the European Union?
I think she is not claiming it, but de facto acknowledging it, yes. She is acting, she points out, and there hasn't been a denial from Brussels that she acts in close coordination with Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council, and in fact with the current presidency, Slovakia. That's why the summit is in Bratislava. But yeah, there's no doubt about it. Having seen Britain voting to leave, the European Union is even more dependent on and to some extent suffering from German predominance.
Rosemary, that referendum as well was only about 8 weeks ago, and again, strangely, seems to have happened at some extremely distant point in the past, or at least
it does feel strange to watch this summitry going on, preparation for Bratislava, and absolutely no mention of the British.
But I'm just wondering, 2 months on from that vote, now that everybody has calmed down a bit, I think, especially as we have witnessed the British government doing its level best to kick this thing as far into the long grass as it decently can. Do you get the sense that the rest of the EU is still regarding this as some sort of crisis for the European Union or potentially an opportunity to sort of forge ahead with the ever closer union without those pesky meddling Brits?
I think that the thing to watch here is those Germans who, and it would be interesting to hear what Sebastian has to say about this, those Germans who are slightly nervous about the idea that they won't have the British with them in the European Union, and that they
plenty
will...
of those.
I beg your pardon?
Plenty of those. Well, there are plenty of those.
Indeed, and there are other Europeans who feel that Germany unrestrained may not be exactly a good thing, and that I was also daring to speculate, supposing, I don't think it's necessarily the case, but just supposing we are at the beginning of the end of Europe or the EU, to follow every move carefully to see how this would work. Merkel realizes that the Czechs are very upset. Are they not?
There speaks a British arrogance. We leave the European Union and it all falls apart. I think that's exactly what won't happen. If the European Union falls apart, it's over the euro. It's got nothing to do with Britain. Britain is obviously Britain leaving is a calamity, and not for anybody more. Hang on, no, for nobody more than for Germany. Nobody, nobody doubts that. Nobody in Germany.
Why especially for Germany? Why is Germany particularly upset?
Because we've always relied on the Brits to be the boo person. You know, the bad cop
to your good cop.
The bad cop to our reluctant cop, and a counterweight with Holland and Finland and, you know, the Scandinavians against the rather fiscally incontinent southerners.
But I take your point that it's more about the euro. However, that is connected, is it not? I mean, that Germany is in the lead in terms of what happens with the euro, and the absence of that restraining factor. I mean, surely the discussions going on as Merkel goes round and visits these other capitals is about how much closer they all ought to get. And the euro is in the heart of that.
Britain, very sadly, has been a semi-detached member of the EU for some time now, ever since they were the ones who pushed for enlargement and then turned round and realised
that
they,
a bad idea.
They didn't like it. I mean, such a waste of strategic and political development.
You can let your irritation roll.
No, sorry. But we know that there are a number of countries. Actually, I mean, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, they're all extremely upset about the Brits leaving. Because, again, they are the ones who haven't got the euro yet and don't want it. And of course, the treaty actually tells them to adopt it sooner or later. So this is going to be a crunch point. But I think there is more to it than just crying into the beer because the Brits have left. I mean, there are interesting developments on the security cooperation front, for example. And of course, the economic problems seem to have eased recently, particularly in France and Germany.
Sebastian, from a domestic political perspective for Chancellor Merkel, how important to her is the image of a statesperson, with all due acknowledgement of the wisdom that nobody votes on foreign affairs? Her approval ratings have come down 12 points to 47, which is admittedly the stuff of Francois Hollande's wildest dreams. But nonetheless, does this work for her domestically in Germany, being seen to be travelling around Europe taking charge?
Well, it's a double-edged sword. In a certain area of the population, I'm sure it'll help, and others will say, "Oh, there, look, she's swanning off and doesn't deal with domestic problems, and she's in hock with the European elites." I mean, don't forget that we have a fairly hefty Eurosceptic party knocking on Parliament's door and having double-digit success in regional elections, not least in her own backyard very soon.
29% of Germans saying they want out of the EU as well, according to recent polls.
Is that right? Well, yes, okay.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Rosemary Hollis and Sebastian Borger. Coming up next, Austria gives itself another chance to put Hofer in the Hofburg.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
There's something about Tokyo. Once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting. Doesn't matter how long I'm here, there's always something new. It's a very, it's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. There's more to discover all the time. And also there's so much that's new in Tokyo. Most months, actually most weeks, there's something new to keep us interested. You know, either it's a new development or a, you know, really interesting new building, a new fashion brand, something going on. So there's always something to keep us interested.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Rosemary Hollis and Sebastian Borger. Now, back in May, Austrians who are politically anywhere to the left of Genghis Khan congratulated themselves on having dodged a bullet as far-right Freedom Party candidate Norbert Hofer was narrowly defeated in a presidential election by the Green Party's Alexander van der Bellen. The Freedom Party successfully challenged the results, however, leading to a rerun on October the 2nd. Norbert Hofer launched his new campaign for the largely ceremonial post yesterday. Sebastian, is he going to win?
Well, it's 50-50, isn't it? It was 50-50 back then.
Just about exactly 50-50, actually.
27,000 votes in a country of 8 million people. And it's 50-50 now. I worry. You could argue, I suppose, that he may have mobilized all the people agreeing with and to the right of Genghis Khan, and that some on the left and in the sort of the middle of society, the bourgeois middle of society, may have been a little bit, how shall I put it, reluctant to vote for a Green. Or indeed not bothered particularly, because they couldn't imagine a result like the one.
So you think turnout may be higher this time?
Turnout may even go higher than it was, and some people may have made an effort to actually go and vote. On the other hand, of course, you could say, well, people might say he's won the challenge on technical grounds. I mean, there was no manipulation or anything, but he won the challenge. He's the younger man of the two. Van der Bellen always looks a little bit old to me. Heavy smoker. Anyway, that maybe people say, oh, well, let's give the younger man a chance. I honestly think it's 50-50.
Rosemary, looking at Austria from outside Austria, how bad a look is it for Austria internationally if it does elect a far-right populist to the presidency, largely ceremonial though it is?
I think it's one of many signals that tell my generation that our day is over. The post-World War II generation who thought that the ideals of the European Union were going to triumph. And now we realise that actually the forces of darkness, the preference for a kind of tribalist, me first, verging on racist attitude towards running countries, is not going to go away.
But Rosemary, I mean, first of all, your generation, I mean, your generation, we are still in charge. There are still lots of us in charge, shall I put it this way. And isn't the problem that we've grown complacent about certain things, that we put fences around certain questions? I mean, migration, I honestly think in my own country, in Austria, also in Britain, for too long wasn't talked about. And then people found outlets in parties and in politicians who have absolutely no solutions, populist slogans.
On that subject, though, Sebastian, in terms of Austria, and I say this with all due deference to the reinvention and rethinking that Germany did about these things in the years following the war, but among Austrians, is there no self-consciousness at all about the prospect of electing to senior office a far-right nationalist populist who demonises minorities?
I know exactly where you're heading to.
It is the obvious question.
And look, listen, I mean, I have plenty of Austrian friends. I write for an Austrian newspaper and they are aghast. There's no doubt about it. But they have the same elite problem, worse so in Austria than in many other countries, that the elite of centre-left and centre-right for 40 years basically said, this is our state and you for any minor post in the government, you need to be either of the SPÖ, the center left, or the ÖVP, the center right. I mean, it is really quite worrying. And there comes someone who says, "Let's smash the establishment," Jörg Haider, 30 years ago, and leads the FPÖ to this success of which Hofer is the sad culmination.
Well, I won't disagree with you that the problem has been the complacency of my generation, who have had the reins of power and have turned into the very kind of people that the UKIP leader Nigel Farage and Donald Trump in the United States like to berate as complacent professionals with too much expertise for their own good and too much arrogance.
Well, moving seamlessly along, finally, on that subject, we will stick with that motif of belligerent populist blowhards running for president on a platform of loudly resenting everyone who isn't a middle-aged straight white male.
I come to you from the United Kingdom with a message of hope and a message of optimism. It's a message that says, if the little people, if the real people, if the ordinary decent people are prepared to stand up and fight for what they believe in. We can overcome the big banks. We can overcome the multinationals. And we did it. We made June the 23rd our Independence Day when we smashed the establishment.
Nigel Farage there, former leader of the United Kingdom Independence Party, speaking last night to a Donald Trump rally in Jackson, Mississippi. Polls are currently predicting a spectacular thrashing for Trump in November, but, runs the unmistakable subtext of the invitation to Farage, polls also predicted the same for his campaign, pandering to the baser instincts of that cohort of the population who wish it could somehow be 1962 again. Rosemary, how many Donald Trump supporters do we imagine know or care who Nigel Farage is?
Well, I think it's only about 20%. They haven't apparently heard of Brexit. It would be totally uncharacteristic of American politics for them to be paying any attention to in detail to British politics, let alone knowing the name of a man who wasn't in the British Parliament, has never achieved leadership in the British political system, and was campaigning to get Britain out of the EU, which is a concept I'm sure they don't understand. Or care about. I'm in danger of being arrogant again here.
There's not really any reason why they would care about it, in fairness. Sebastian, why is Donald Trump campaigning in Mississippi at all? Because though polls are looking bad for him, I reckon those six Electoral College votes are in the bag for him.
Well, it's home ground, isn't it? And he likes to have adoring crowds, and he gets them in those areas. I still think it's very interesting to invite Nigel Farage, who is, of course, when you talk to people in the Leave campaign here in Britain, who were desperate to distance themselves from him and his very Marmite kind of politician. That's a phrase that an Australian in this studio will understand.
We would call it... The equivalent in Australia is Vegemite, which everybody in Australia loves.
I beg your pardon.
If you say anything against Vegemite in Australia, you have to hand in your passport. That is the law.
Okay, sorry. Anyway, you know what I mean. Someone who is adored by a very fanatical minority and who is loathed by most other people. And of course, Farage claiming that he was behind, or Trump trying to claim that Farage was the man behind Brexit is a complete aberration from the truth. In that sense, of course, wholly consistent with his campaign.
Rosemary, the thing that I could not help but notice was that though Nigel Farage said he wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton if someone paid him, he did not actually endorse at any point voting for Donald Trump. He spoke at his rally.
I suppose this is Farage, and he did acknowledge that in one of the things that he said, that given that he resented so much, or said he did, what Barack Obama had done to come over to Britain and, as far as Farage was concerned, patronise the British by telling them how to vote in the EU referendum, he couldn't bring himself to tell Americans how to vote, but he needed to get some message across. I mean, I was listening to the phrases that Farage was using, and I was wondering how much he'd calculated what the English that works very well with a section of the British electorate, how much to edit that for it to be at all comprehensible to a US electorate.
It was mostly the taking back control motif, wasn't
it? He might vote for the Green candidate, of course. Who knows in America?
I think on that incongruous note, we will have to leave it there. Time is against us. Rosemary Hollis and Sebastian Borger, thank you very much for joining us. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Molly Ingleby. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. More music next with Carlotta. Then at 1900, you can hear The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And I'll have more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. Your host is our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. For now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.